Chapter 9. Now apologize, unless that would make things worse. Step 9. We made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Secretly, I always like the look of this step. It's cinematic. It involves a quest. It has the drama of me moseying through the past, all full of potent Sergio Leone scored wisdom, offering squinting and self-righteous apologies to all the people I had hurt. Rogue that I was. By the time I reached step 9, I had been disabused of this shallow romanticism. Step 9 is a good example of the intersection of pragmatism and mysticism that this program demonstrates again and again. What's the point in spirituality if it doesn't make you feel better? If you don't feel better as a result of doing this program, there's no point doing it. You might as well carry on with whatever demented behavior you were employing in the first place. It's practical because it is on the surface solely about action. You have made a list of all the people that you have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. Now you crack on and make those amends. This means researching and soul searching. Researching because you may, for example, just off the top of my head, need to track down the head of accounts at MTV UK in the late 90s. It involves soul searching because of the caveat, unless to do so would injure them or others. In my step 8, there were instances where it was very difficult for me to become willing. I talked you through the process of forgiveness that was required with my stepdad. I had to unpick all the wrongs I believed he'd done to me to have a clear view of the wrongs I'd done to him. Then I had to decide what form the amends would take. By the time I'd gotten round to forgiving him and becoming ready, he was no longer with my mum. He was no longer immediately accessible, which gave me a reason to avoid him. Also, I reasoned, he was always a quiet man, not given to discussing emotions, and would probably find this whole business bloody embarrassing. Neither of these rationalisations constitute justifiable inaction. While I was contemplating him and the process involved, one thought kept returning. In my autobiography, My Bookie Wook, I'd laid into him with a total lack of restraint, with relish actually. I'd written only my side of the argument and gracelessly depicted him as a kind of Dickensian villain. In the subsequent years, with all the muck-raking tabloid newspapers knocking on any door that might provide a story, they must have found him, and he never uttered a word. This was at odds with my long-held image of my stepdad. It is unignorably principled and kind. This small recognition became the aperture through which a new dawn is beheld. The reality that I hold within is not absolute. It is a construct. If it does not serve me, if it is not objectively authentic, then why not change it? The light of this new dawn thaws the cold, intransigent past. Then a coincidence. Anyone that has worked this program will tell you how often coincidences occur, how frequently people that you need to meet are put in front of you, how you encounter signs. It can be kind of annoying as the spooky reverence people give to these events is part of the limp, new age, airy, fairy aspect of spirituality that many find understandably repellent. Nevertheless, I have found that since I've begun to place less prominence on materialism and my own egotistical demands of the world, coincidences have occurred more frequently. Or at least have seemed to. Who cares? In this case, I was visiting Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital. Didn't I mention it? I'm a pretty great guy. And standing at the foot of the first bed of the first ward of this vast institution I was taken to was my stepdad's nephew. His son was the patient. We chatted and I asked him about my stepdad. He gave me his number. I was able to reach out by phone and he didn't respond to texts or calls, indicating that understandably he didn't want anything to do with me. I wrote him a letter taking full responsibility for my actions, offering to make amends in any way that he saw fit. I apologised and wished him well and asked if I could do anything for him. I didn't hear back, but now view the relationship differently. I have amended my attitude to him, and with it my perception of the past and my behaviour going forward. I now acknowledge that I am often wrong in my interpretations of other people's behaviour, and that I am better off not to judge them at all. An approach that would have been inconceivable to the person I used to be, the person I am when not working a programme, the person I default to. The amends step is an indication of change, real change. At points, it does feel like I'm going through the motions, but this in itself facilitates authentic personal development. Fake it till you make it, they often say. In my previous life, and I suspect in the lives of many of you, little reference is made to spirit and conscious ritual. Mostly we are engaged in material pursuits of one kind or another, the many obligations of ordinary life having ensnared and enslaved. It's not easy to float about like a Sufi if you've got three kids and a mortgage, or you're trying to get promoted to pay extortionate urban rent. Much of that upon which happiness depends is beyond mechanistic definition. The machinations of the mind and spirit cannot be easily measured. In step 9, I felt the palpable presence of the sacred each time I made a face-to-face amends. The structure of the language that the protocol suggests acts as a secular spell, summoning ethereal witness, as if a gently burning circle or an impromptu chapel appears on uttering these apparently quite unremarkable words. As you know, I am an addict. Part of the process of my recovery from addiction is that I must make amends to those I have wronged. I have wronged you, and I owe you an amends. This simple sentence is the entry point to your face-to-face amends, and somehow its words form an arch through which you walk into a quieter space, a space that is not just occupied by you and the other person. It's as if somehow something has been evoked, some hidden principle. Each time I have done it, I have felt a subtle awe and unbidden tearfulness. I have felt humbled. I have felt the grace that occurs when you decide to put aside your own way of doing things and surrender to another way. That said, it is a practical measure that can be deployed more bureaucratically. Some people suggest the rather more prosaic introduction. Periodically, I review my life to determine if I have harmed anybody. I feel I may have harmed you. With no reference to spirituality or particular addictions. If you are conducting this process because you would like to engage with a more purposeful life without addressing any specific behaviour, this form is appropriate. This is the suggested structure. 1. Tell the person the harm. Focused and to the point. No excuses. 2. Ask the person if they want to comment or if they'd like to add anything else, then shut up and listen. I find that part especially hard. 3. Suggest the amends you'd like to make. 4. Ask the person if the amends is acceptable or if they'd like additional or different amends. The amends you offer ought to be commensurate with the harm done. With my MTV friend, who I'd denied access to my work cab account, which elsewhere I'd misused with selfish abandon, I met up with him, apologised as described above, and organised a flash car to pick him up from work and drive him home. This is what you might call a light-hearted amends. Nonetheless, when I think back to my shame regarding the selfishness of my earlier actions, this personal ritual has assuaged my self-loathing and healed the damage between us. Don't worry about him. He writes for Ant and Dec these days. He's having a gay old time. My amends to my parents and a number of ex-girlfriends were rather less jocund. They consisted of a frank, quiet apology and a commitment to being a different man going forward. My relationships with my parents have radically improved and are clear and honest now. It's worth reflecting again at this point that this program has now been applied to dozens of addictions. It amazes me still that once beyond the initial acknowledgement of our inability to control the behavior or substance in question, we tackle an issue that is far beyond it. The way we relate to ourselves and others and life more broadly. We embrace our life as something to be pursued with purpose, not blindly and unconsciously endured. What is actually happening when I make amends to work colleagues or exes? Who or what am I actually communing with? In a sense, it is myself. I'm committing to being a different man, to myself. Have you ever inadvertently made amends to someone tearfully or perhaps drunkenly, or sheepishly apologized to a slighted friend, aware of the need but unsure of how to do it? I have. Simple guidelines such as don't make excuses for your behavior and let them speak would have made a world of difference. Have you had someone apologize to you, a fellow driver or a life partner, who has said, I'm sorry you feel I was rude to you? When I get those apologies, I want to shove the apologizer into a ravine. That is because this program merely formalizes what we all spiritually intuit, that there is a way to make an apology, and apologizing for making a person feel something instead of for what you did is not a mea culpa. It's a eua culpa. Some step nines can't be made because to do so would injure them or others. The point of doing these steps is to make us useful. I hesitate to say happy because happiness to me seems like such a wet-gummed frivolity, dumb and fleeting. If you think about it too much, it'll disappear, like an erection. Usefulness. Purpose. These ideas are robust enough to weather the turbulent meteorology of the mind. If making a particular amends will harm the person you are making it to, don't make it. If it would give them information that would be painful to them, or if seeing you again would be traumatic, refrain. These potential complications are further demonstrations of the necessity for guidance in this process. I talk through each instance on step 8 with my mentor and what I propose as an amends. This means that me and my crazy old caused all these problems in the first place brain are not being entrusted with the means of resolution. Similarly, if making an amends might land you in jail, it should be approached with extreme caution. We should be willing to deal with the consequences of our actions, and many practitioners of this program say that willingness to go to any length to change means we should be prepared to face even jail. In my personal experience, there was little of a criminal nature that needed to be amended. Stealing from MTV is a crime. Obviously, I was using illicit drugs, but most of my wrongs amounted to cheating and exploiting people and being incredibly selfish. Under guidance, I still concluded that a good many people would be best addressed by letter, that the last thing they'd want was me looming back into their lives with combed hair and good intentions. I didn't believe my promiscuity was wrong for the many years that it governed my life. I thought that it was acceptable. I knew I had little control over it, and at my core sensed it had more to do with lacking love, connection and meaning than chasing orgasms, but I certainly didn't think I was harming anyone else. Now I know that by participating in another person's unconscious behavior, especially if it's destructive or harming to their self-esteem, I am participating in their pain. This is all the more troubling because when awakened, I have an opportunity to assist their healing. Some people didn't want any further contact with me, which I have to accept as a consequence of my behavior. Some people, and this is common, were embarrassed by the process but still grateful. My first ever step 9 was with Matt Morgan, a dear friend who I used with and worked with a lot, arguably causing him a lot more harm in the second phase of my addiction than in the earlier, more obvious substance misuse phase. I made amends to him in my room at a posh London hotel. Matt took the bizarre measure of holding a cushion in front of his face as I tried to remain pious. In this case, the wrongs I was seeking to atone for were giving him drugs, involving him in a seedy and unpleasant world of addiction, and being controlling and obstructive around our work together. Matt, when he emerged from behind the cushion, said he had no problem with the sex and drug stuff, but that he did feel aggrieved by my controlling work behaviour, even listing examples of harm done to him that I myself had forgotten. The fact that it is challenging for the recipient as well as the person making the amends is, I believe, a testament to its authenticity. People know that something real is happening. We live in a world that is dominated by rationalism, where emotions are often excluded. In Victorian Britain, as industrialisation and urbanisation consumed the land, several of London's rivers were submerged beneath paving and concrete so the teeming flow couldn't interrupt the mechanical march. Beneath the concrete of our conditioning flow the rivers of our better nature, awaiting liberation. The majority of my amends were scheduled, but there were occasions where a surprise on-the-spot Step 9 was required. In my professional life, a good many people were hurt when I severed relationships believing they were no longer useful to me. This was often done in an irresponsible way that caused harm. One man who had promoted my live work for a long time had been coldly dispatched without explanation and was very hurt. I'd never acknowledged the harm I'd done him and didn't really think about it. A mutual friend told me that I'd caused suffering, and once aware it played on my mind and I began to see how I'd transgressed, that I'd been selfish and irresponsible. One night at a live show I ran into him. An indication that on some level I knew I'd done wrong was that I felt a churning in my guts on seeing him. It was my own neglected code that I was not abiding by, not a learned dogma. My body viscerally let me know that I needed to make amends, not a blank and learned moral code. This step is about making ourselves right with the world. So many of us are encumbered with fear and shame. These feelings are affirmed if we can't go out into the world without running into wounded people whom understandably regard us unfavourably. It becomes easy to see that our relationships with people become the instantiations of negative attitudes to ourselves. I believe myself to be ugly. I behave in an ugly way. I then have relationships with others that confirm my belief, a self-perpetuating doctrine. The person I used to be, on sighting a person with whom there was bad blood, would either avoid the person or front the situation out. Like most people, I did not want to change. I wanted to justify staying the same. If you had my childhood, my problems, my mental illness, then you would behave like this too. This, though, is a program of change. You accept you want to change. You believe change is possible. You become willing to receive input from new sources, possibly the group, possibly a mentor, possibly a higher power, ideally all three. And then you examine where you've been going wrong, share it, and commit to new attitudes. This completed, you start to deal with all the damage you've done while living by your previous program, usually a clumsily accreted bundle of cliches and responses to abuse and trauma. I felt sick when I ran into my former colleague, but I knew what I had to do. I humbly approached him and said I had something I needed to tell him if he had the time. Given it was a comedy gig at the Apollo Theatre in London and he was promoting it, he would have been well within his rights to avoid this uncomfortable conversation. Instead, he said sure, and when he had a moment, he led me to a backstage office. In the interim, I found time to pray in a toilet. This may seem peculiar to a modern secular person, but most of us recognise this impulse, the occasional need to have a word with ourselves. I know I did, long before I regarded it as spiritual. My whole life I've been locking myself in toilets to summon up a transcendent experience of one kind or another, as a kid gorging on chocolate, then puking it up, then frenetically spellbound by porn, then drugs, then finally prayer. In every instance, the need was the same, to get out of my head, to feel a connection, to feel something beyond being me in a body on a planet in infinite space. I contest that we all have this yearning for connection, even if from a humanist perspective. What is the numinous jolt we feel when witnessing the heroic sacrifice of another? Or the tearful pull when people come together in a common cause? What string is being plucked when we encounter heroism? Could it be that we are reminded by the hero sacrifice that the appearance of individualism is temporal? That when the hero sees beyond this artificial world of selfish wants and needs and falls in faith into the arms of the ulterior oneness, we are reminded and relieved? What is the value of fraternity? What is solidarity's power? What manner of virtue is kindness if it is not the acknowledgement that in truth and in fact we are all one, together here, and what we do to each other we do to ourselves? Heroism's power is in redolence. It reminds us what we've always known but forgotten. We are all connected. In prayer at the Apollo, I appeal to this oneness. I steel myself with the knowledge that when walking this path, I am no longer a cluster of cells and wants, a priapic and salivating happiness maximizer. I am attempting to tune into the mainframe. He leads me into the office. It's loud outside because the act is about to go on stage, but in the room it is quiet. I speak with as low a voice as circumstances allow, taking responsibility for my actions precisely as the step suggests. Then it's his turn to talk. He tells me of the pain caused by my cold severance, of the consequences it had for him in his career and his private life. Listening to this, I feel vulnerable. I viscerally feel how my unconscious and uncaring behaviour has caused this man to suffer. It is good for me to listen to this. It is good for me to acknowledge that it hurts me to have hurt him, that I cannot close the door on the suffering of others. I silently stand and take it. When he has finished, I ask if there's anything I can do for him. He's a pretty masculine northern bloke and predictably says he's fine, Tar, very much. Afterwards, I feel a little perturbed as I join my friends at the gig, uncertain in my anxiety as to whether it was the right thing to do, raking up the past, reopening old wounds. Does it do me any good? Did it do him any good? Before the comic comes on stage, though, my former colleague reappears and, noticeably awkward but with kindly deliberation, presents me with 4 after-show passes. In the muted language of men of a certain background and age, this constitutes forgiveness. He moves on quite brusquely, but perhaps a little healed. Certainly he had no need to seek me out with an additional gesture of goodwill. I know that how I treated him and the many other people on my list was wrong. I know too that I'm not a bad person. I was a person who had lost my way, but with the program, I no longer need to harm myself or others. The last 10 years of my life have been carried out publicly. Romances, a marriage, scandals and controversy. I have sought to work this step wherever I could. Sometimes amends are general. A broad personal observation is that since being relieved of my epic, grandiose and all-consuming substance misuse, the drives that fueled it have easily been channeled into my sexual, romantic and professional life. In these areas, then, I have not been living according to my higher self. That doesn't mean my behaviour has been uniformly bad. I've had one-night stands that were characterised by tremendous honesty and tenderness. I've had professional relationships and experiences that have bordered on the sublime. In both of these areas, though, there were streams of my life where adrenaline and excess are seen as permissible. If, as I was, you are a young and famous man, having sex with lots of women is encouraged. If you are temperamental in your working life, given to erratic outbursts and emotional crashes, this will be tolerated for as long as you are making people money. Remember, we're not discussing the breach of external codes or laws here. We're not talking about illegal activity, corruption, theft, or non-consensual relationships. Those carry their own social penalties. We are talking about our own inner code, innate and ignored while we transgress, but perennially present. I can see now that if I'm physically using a woman when I know that it will be of no benefit to either of us beyond short-term pleasure, which is, let's face it, an extremely effective and diverting reward system, then I am participating in bad faith activity. This is because I now know that I cannot be fulfilled by transient pleasures, and that as an awakening man, my attitude towards women is to be one of nurture, kindness and generosity. My condition led me to see everyone and everything as a resource. This was not calculated, it was unconscious. I didn't, in the swirl of eye contact with a beautiful woman, inwardly cackle like a vampire. I was simply lulled into dumb fulfillment by the current of a continual unconscious drive. From a step 9 perspective, this pattern was conducted for too long a period for direct amends to be appropriate. Also, for a recovering sex addict in a monogamous relationship, it's inadvisable to go skipping down memory lane equipped with doe-eyed apologies and good intentions into the company of previous lovers. My amends in this area are living amends, which means I no longer view women in the way I once did, neither do I conduct myself in that manner. Furthermore, I actively look for opportunities to be of assistance to women in appropriate ways. In my case, this means selflessly and, where possible, with complete anonymity. Believe me, I'd like nothing more than at this point to divulge a litany of worthy women's causes of which I am a proud benefactor, but I'm too spiritual, so you just have to take my word for it. Amy, as a former sex worker, chronic addict, and beloved friend, provides me with the perfect opportunity to make a general amends to women. Not for women, although my changing attitude and behaviour will, I'm sure, be beneficial to others, it's for myself that this process is taken, to move me into alignment with a higher vision of myself. The tension, guilt, and sadness I feel when living in addiction is to me an indication of an awareness that there is another way of being, a higher, preferable way. I don't believe these are taught social codes or petty bourgeois ideals. I believe this to be a marrow-deep, helix-hard presence that wants to realize itself in the same way that a tree is moving to self-realization from the moment the seed splits, perhaps before, perhaps it is an unbroken spiral of root and branch reaching through what we call time back to the creation of life itself. So my working an amends process is not a mechanical means to get myself back on a Father Christmas's nice list. It's an attempt to align myself with an inner attention that exists unbidden within me and informs me when it's not being heard by making me feel bad. This is different, I think, from transgressing a taught social code, like using the wrong knife with the wrong hand at the wrong banquet. Perhaps the flush of shame we feel when we breach external protocols references this resource, but how we treat each other, how we manifest or deny love, I feel relates to a deeper force even than our primal drives and appetites. If this were a program backed by pop science, I'd now regale you with tales of the oxytocin ballet and dopamine dance that takes place when we are altruistic or in proximity to our beloved. But this biochemical analysis amounts to a fashionable and semantically novel reworking of what yogis, sages, Sufis and saints have been telling us for millennia as the result of their limitless work in laboratories that are subtler than those forged in concrete and glass. Love is the answer. Amy in the house comes with a poltergeist. She brings the spirit of addiction with her like a floating contagion. Even the way that the Weetabix box looks cast to the side like someone has interfered with it at a bus stop. She is the ultra-addict. It's curled up in her like a cat without fur purring quietly. She's a frightened and frightening child. I am agitated when she's here and when she's gone. Knowing she is patient zero, knowing she carries it in its purest form. I'm cautious the day after she leaves, the spare room almost cordoned off with yellow tape. I feel like I breathe the tail of the ghost. I feel it in me when she's passed. I find myself bathed in fridge light, eating chocolate I don't remember wanting, and my thoughts turn to porn, insidious thoughts. Not like the lumpen and clumsy addiction of my youth, ham-fisted wanks and heroin. Now this fiend, armed with my intellect, could trick me into the sewers unnoticed. Preceding even my first thought, there it sits in my gut and my bones, the lazy contagion. My dreams are a grey playground, but I never want to leave them, even for the heavenly wonder of my family home. The addiction sits there quietly in my gut, like a timeless affiliate of all the addiction that's gone before, impersonal, beyond me and beneath me. It feels so physical. That's why I suppose the call to action is so strong. either to get high or drunk or to have sex, something that changes the way that I feel. Amy got 18 months clean from heroin at a BAC treatment facility in the Midlands in the UK. She is not every pale face on an escalator, every glum, staring, gridlocked prisoner nursing an addiction to spending, work, porn or relationships. She is, in fact, a pamphlet addict. Jarringly beautiful, her battle with addiction takes place in an identifiable and obvious context, lit up by her face. In the 10 years that I've known her, Amy has had a year, 6 months, maybe even 2 years clean at different times. One of her most devastating relapses took place while she was a first-year student at drama school. Her attainment of a place at one of the most prestigious drama schools in the world, where a handful of students per year are selected from thousands of applicants, is a staggering achievement. This is a woman who has known suffering, usually confined to people from other countries and other centuries, epic abuse and dispossession. For her, heroin addiction was a sensible response to unendurable pain. During the third term of her course, she relapsed hard, blood on cubicle walls, gouging out in classrooms, grant money all spent on drugs, and she had to leave. This was painful as a spectator, let alone as a protagonist, confirmation of the thumping supremacy of this disease against all ornamentation and seeming success. Over the next 3 years, Amy got clean again, mostly at the same BAC facility where she lived and worked. Group therapy, individual therapy, community integration, personal responsibility, all that. She reapplied to drama school, did the necessary 4 auditions to get to the final round, made her peace with the shocked and disappointed staff. Then, the Friday before the Monday's shoo-in audition, relapsed on crack and heroin. Amy went quiet in the days before her final audition, cagey, AWOL, politely dismissive texts. When the calamitous news came from a third party as a euphemistic inquiry, "Have you spoken to Amy?" I barely had the energy to sigh. I met her the next day on Finchley Road, a thankless dual carriageway, and along she came, made of broken branches, a dim film over her, departed. I asked her to talk me through the events and how the events related to thoughts and where the fork in the road occurred, where the departure took place, and the answer surprised me. Amy had naturally been excited about her drama school audition and the prospect of reclaiming a lost opportunity. Drama school became, in the parlance of recovery, her higher power, the thing that was going to make life all right. For an addict, this is a big no-no. You cannot ever elect an ersatz totem, a false idol. Of course we want to. I do it every 10 seconds. It could be a part in a film, a passing stranger, or a can of Diet Coke. If I get that, I'll be all right, I think. Not those words. It's quicker and more insidious than words. It's just a shift of attention and intention from the understanding that I'm here to be useful to the idea that I am an objective pursuing robot. Understandably, the lonely and damaged little girl that Amy to some degree will always be thought that if she could get into drama school again, everything would be okay. This became her focus. She said she felt both excited and afraid, that she couldn't control her feelings, so she started to manage her moods through her eating, binging and vomiting. In addict world, if you are a declared addict, you'll know this. There is a clear, if totally unfair, hierarchy of addictions. The worst, therefore best, addiction is intravenous heroin addiction. Then crack and heroin smoke together. Then a tier where booze, pills and weed all rattle around. Then food, gambling and sex. Then relationships and work. Now, obviously, there are people who can devastate their lives through sex and gambling, and others who can use crack relatively consequence-free. But as a general guide, superficially, that is the Champions League, mid-table, relegation struggler shape of the situation. The more you learn about addiction and the craving and thinking that accompany it, the more these divisions seem redundant, the distinctions melt away. That is why we shouldn't be surprised that Amy, a lifelong hard drug user from the top tier, unthinkingly became obsessed with work, then food, before, on the Friday, I was puking up into the toilet having eaten a load of chocolate, when the thought occurred to me that if I'm doing this, all this puking, crouching over a toilet, I might as well be using. I went down to the cash point, drew out 200 quid, went to this estate in Hackney where I see this homeless couple and said I'd get them a couple of bags if they'd get me 5 of each. Amy had 18 months clean when she made that decision. In that moment, the idea of calling another addict for help or willpower or the promise of a bright future treading the boards were all swept away by the private tide of addiction. What does that craving want? What manner of impulse is this that has evolved? An instinct to destroy the host vessel. Total self-destruction. Amy is interesting because in the inflated, bloated grotesqueness of her condition, we might be able to see patterns that are invisible in less obvious cases. I would maintain, though, that the shape, the template, is uniform. How does this example relate to Carl Jung's verdict that what chronic addicts need is a spiritual experience and ongoing communal support? How does it relate to the 12-step movements that began in the United States, inspired by Jung's insight in the decades that followed? Anyone who suffers from food issues knows how total and dreadful it is. Family members feel the same stranded impotence that a drug addict's family feels. Gamblers that have crossed over know the helplessness, shame, and despair that this condition brings. These are the outliers in whom the universal condition is acute and therefore observable. Our natural yearnings are running amok and they are being stirred and nourished by a society that uses our desire as its fuel. Consumerism and materialism are creating a culture of addiction. We are all on the scale somewhere because we are kept there by the age we live in. Junkies like Amy are at the inverted summit. Her name twists the knife. Amy Winehouse was similar to Amy, similar in that she was somehow housed in the heavens and the gutter, in that she could make your jaw drop with her gift and your heart sink with her affliction. When Amy Winehouse died, and I blame myself perhaps vainly for not having done something, I said to myself, I swore in fact, that Amy would not go the same way. As if I have that kind of power. She ricochets between worlds. One name is not enough for this addict. I never meet the woman that goes out and uses. I am never able to intercept her. I only meet the agonizingly demure and sweetly repentant woman who wants to recover. When the darkness comes, she retreats like an animal. In Amy, I watch from the sidelines as the efficacy of the program is played out. Will she? Won't she? She may yet die from this condition. I sometimes despair. I sometimes think maybe it's inevitable. In her, I see this way is not some life improvement method like hair gel for a soul that needs styling. It is doing the job that religion is once said to have done. People, me and probably you, also need total change. We need epiphany, we need transcendence, but we really dig TV, so we defer. I can get away with a day of selfish thinking and dumb distraction. I mean, I feel like shit, but it doesn't kill me. Amy, though, is going to have to get to redemption through a narrow gap. This program can create that space. In some people, the call is strong. They need either hard drugs or hard recovery. Hard recovery means no more bullshit, no more little kicks and fixes, nothing that can take you away from the connection, the truth, the purpose, the oneness, the moment. It means that this, recovery, is now the framework for the experience of being you, not pleasure or envy or passing memes and pipe dreams. No, it is this system, a system that is designed to change your perspective, give you a connection and then a purpose to maintain it. In step 9, we make restitution that in our old life, our old plan, we would never have countenanced. It is a fine example of the broader 12-step philosophical trope that you can't think your way into acting better, but you can act your way into thinking better. Under the guidance of a mentor, with the support and community of other people on the same path, you have, by following the actions suggested by this program, broken loose from your prior confinement and become a different person. While step 9 seems to be about making amends to others, it is we who are amended. Step 9 exercises. Now apologize, unless that would make things worse. We don't make amends if in doing so we'd cause additional harm. An obvious example, if you've had an affair with a person who's in a relationship, you don't saunter into their parlour and sob all over their doilies telling them you've been diddling their husband. No one is helped by that. But you can't use this clause as a way to avoid amends that you ought to make, like a crafty and brilliant barrister. In 12-step legend, there are burglars that have risked imprisonment by going back to the houses they have robbed and making amends to the occupant. You should follow the guidance of a mentor, the person that helped you through the steps to this point, and perhaps start with the many amends that are free from complexity. The instructions are simple. Discuss each potential amends with a mentor. Then, meet with the person, tell them the harm, apologize, offer an appropriate amends. If it's financial, it's obvious. Generally, the amends is to evoke the opposite feeling of the harm. Ask if they have anything to add and if they think your amends is satisfactory. Your general demeanour ought to be calm and humble. The experience varies depending on the nature of the harm and the recipient of the amends. When I have done it, I have often felt a deeper connection with my negative behaviour and the consequences of my actions for others. In conducting the amends, I have seen how I am changing, amending, becoming a different man. Ask yourself, am I willing to change? Am I willing to be changed in ways I may not be aware of or in control of? Am I willing to address each harm that I am aware of? Am I being completely honest with my mentor about the nature of the harm? Have I thoroughly prepared each amend with a mentor? Am I willing to complete all my amends using creative solutions for individuals I can't meet? Is finishing my amends a top priority in my life? Have I finished my amends? Am I avoiding some?